Okay, welcome everyone. Happy to introduce our candidate for the Director of Library position here at EMU. Gary Daught comes to us from Milligan College in Tennessee, where he's currently the Director of Library Services there. Gary has had multiple graduate degrees. He did his bachelor's work at University of Florida in agriculture. I didn't ask him how you get from agriculture, ornamental horticulture to librarianship, but maybe there's something there. An aesthetic component to each of those jobs, I would think. But then went on to do a Master of Divinity at New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, a Master's in Theology at Union Theological just down the road in Richmond, and then his Master of Arts in Library Science at University of Arizona. And in between those various things, he's had a career in church work as a pastor. Perhaps most relevant for us, he was pastor of the Mennonite Church in Tucson for a number of years, and also library and publishing work along the way before he began at Milligan in 2007. So I'm eager to hear what he has to say about the role of libraries and our work together. And Gary, welcome.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here and to meet each. Majority of you thus far I've encountered already today. That's great, or I re-encountered from the past. That's also great. There is a scene in an old episode of The Simpsons where Reverend Lovejoy is at the Springfield Public Library checking out a copy of the Bible. At the circulation desk, the librarian asks, "You've checked this Bible out every weekend for the last 9 years. Wouldn't it be easier just to buy one?" With a hint of incredulity in his voice, Reverend Lovejoy replies, "Perhaps on a librarian's salary." I resonate with this scene because it anticipates in a humorous way something of my own vocational path to librarianship after spending many years in congregational ministry. Before becoming a librarian, as was mentioned, I was pastor at the Shalom Mennonite Fellowship in Tucson, Arizona, serving there 6 years from 1997 to 2003. But with a particular penchant for scholarship and a strong attraction to the academic environment, I found myself in the Graduate Information Resources and Library Science program at the University of Arizona there in Tucson. I graduated from this program in December of 2004, and in March of 2005, I was hired to my first professional library position as reference and collection development librarian at Milligan College, a Christian liberal arts college in Northeast Tennessee. In August of 2007, I was promoted to Director of Library Services, a position that I hold to this day. Librarianship has proven to be a perfect fit for me, and I have flourished in it. Though the word is still out on Reverend Lovejoy's assessment of the extravagant lifestyles of librarians. I am candidating for the position of director of the Sadie A. Hartzler Library here at Eastern Mennonite University. I was not really looking for another job, but I was attracted to the position in no small part because it has opened at an Anabaptist Mennonite higher education institution at a point in my library career where I am legitimately and well qualified to apply. I think I may have been waiting for this opportunity ever since I first embarked upon this vocational path over 10 years ago. It is very meaningful to me to be re-affiliated in my work with the faith tradition that I associate with, where the teacher-student relationship in Jesus's call to discipleship in community and his way of reconciliation and peacemaking is affirmed and embraced, I knew I had to apply. I want to speak to you this afternoon about opportunities for the Liberal Arts University Library as we delve deeper into this second decade of the 21st century. My suggestions are informed by engagement with the academic and professional library literature, attention to trends in library and information technology, observations of the information use behaviors and habits of students and faculty at my own library at Milligan College, and my propensity to draw analogies from history. This is a visual, Ben will recognize this. This is a visual representation of the internet, a global system of interconnected network computers initially begun in the late 1960s. Last year, on March 12th, we celebrated the 25th anniversary of the work of Tim Berners-Lee, now Sir Berners-Lee, a computer scientist responsible for developing first the page display language called hypertext markup language, or HTML, and the network protocol known as the World Wide Web. The World Wide Web protocol enabled documents and images to be distributed over the internet using a system of hypertext linking. Perhaps more significant, on April 30th, 1993, the work of Berners-Lee was placed in the public domain, facilitating a democratic and commercial revolution in communication and information creation and dissemination. My interaction with this revolution began on a cold evening in Brandon, Manitoba, Canada in early 1995. I attended a public information meeting put on by a new company calling itself an ISP, Internet Service Provider. The company was offering access to the internet upon which I would be able to send and receive electronic mail and browse across and between hyperlinked web pages of text and image documents. I was totally captivated by the demonstration and I signed up right away. The very next day, I drove down to the local computer store and bought a phone modem to connect my Apple Macintosh Classic computer via the telephone line to the internet. I got a 15-year-old kid in town to supply me with a 3.5-inch floppy disk loaded with the necessary software, and after a few more calls back to that kid to troubleshoot some initial configuration problems, I was successfully online. This was long before search engines like Google came on the scene, and Yahoo was little more than a page of website links organized into broad subject categories. For me and many others in that first wave or two of early adopters, surfing the web was an intriguing and mind-expanding hobby. But before too long, it would become a critical and transformative tool. I can certainly remember, though I am finding it increasingly difficult to imagine, that I could ever perform my job today as a librarian, an information professional, and a scholar before the internet or the World Wide Web. Curiously, there was a heavy dose of skepticism regarding this internet thing on university and college campuses in the early days. And it took some time before the recognized value began to alter faculty teaching and student learning behavior. Even 10 years later, when I first began my first librarian position in 2005, there were still frequent prohibitions placed on students against using such tools as Google and Wikipedia. Some faculty even issued blanket prohibitions in their syllabi against the use of any online or internet resource, which caused no shortage of confusion with students who interpreted this to mean that they weren't allowed to use journal articles from online databases because those articles were accessed using a web browser. Thankfully, we have made it through many of those initial growing pains, but I wonder if we are yet thoroughly convinced, especially considering the role of the library, that this internet thing is not just a fad. Well, let me declare it here. This internet thing is not a fad. The internet has fundamentally impacted how our students think about and interact with information resources. It is worth considering, as I look around, that while some of us here today can remember an information world before there was an internet, most of our students cannot. This fact doesn't mean that our students are incapable of using print books. Print books are not going to disappear from the library shelves tomorrow or anytime soon, for that matter. But the nature of the relationship our students have with information and knowledge resources is increasingly different from our own. Our students' world is a world where print, as the centuries-old dominant technology of information storage and dissemination, is losing its effectiveness in shaping the role that the library needs to play in their educational lives. Admittedly, adapting to technological change is not always easy. Consider Johannes Trithemius, abbot of the Benedictine monastery at Sponheim, Germany. It's the end of the 15th century, and the Gutenberg print revolution is well underway in Europe. Trithemius was a scholar, committed bibliophile, a promoter of the scribal arts. In 1492, he authored a handwritten treatise on monastic scribal arts called De Laud Scriptorium, in praise of scribes. In praise of scribes is a vigorous defense of the practice of hand-copied books. Presumably in the face of the growing acceptance of the printed book in European society. Chapter 7 is entitled That Monks Should Not Stop Copying Because of the Invention of Printing, and includes this choice excerpt. All of you know the difference between a manuscript and a printed book. The word written on parchment will last 1,000 years. The printed word on paper, how long will it last? The most you can expect a book of paper to survive is 200 years. Yet there are many who think they can entrust their works to paper. Only time will tell. What is of particular interest is that less than 2 years later, in 1494, Johannes Trithemius engaged the services of Peter von Friedberg of Mainz to publish a printed edition of De Laud Scriptorium. Given his spirited defense of handwritten copying, this decision would appear to have been an open contradiction. But Trithemius knew very well that the printed book was bound to reach a much larger audience than a manuscript. If his instructions in the art of copying were to be effective, he had to ensure the greatest possible circulation for them. It turns out that Johannes Trithemius was no mere apologist for a has-been publishing technology. Yes, he clearly stood at a point of technological transition, and a discomforting change was in the air. But only the most prejudiced scholar would spurn the advantages of new forms of communication that could enhance dissemination of and access to ideas, even if those ideas included a vigorous defense of the threatened culture. Prejudice would be compounded if he insisted on holding on to outdated information about this changing scene. Reputable purveyors like Peter von Friedberg of these new technologies could be found. Trithemius's nuanced response provides us with some useful guidance as we stand at our own technological transition between the analog and the digital, and the impact that it is having on the library. The library is often a centrally located and architecturally distinctive building on a college or university campus. The reason for this is related to the library's long-standing and long-affirmed function as a storehouse of accumulated human knowledge embodied in its collections of physical books and other information artifacts. Historically, this storehouse of knowledge would interact with the mission of the university, which involved imparting the accumulated knowledge of human culture and civilization to new generations of young adults as they prepared to take their place as full citizens within society and the world. Through this historic interaction, the library has played two simultaneous and mutually reinforcing roles. It was a potent symbol of the embodiment of human knowledge and a single point of access to that body of human knowledge. The ideas, thoughts, expressions, and discoveries of past and present scholars, statesmen, authors, philosophers, theologians, artists, and scientists were committed to physical media, particularly ink on paper, for the capture and dissemination. Libraries were created to gather, preserve, and provide access to these information and knowledge artifacts in the service of teaching and learning. When for generations the professor told his or her students to go to the library to complete an assignment or conduct research, it was because the student had little choice. The library was the place, the only place, where the books and journals could be accessed. The practical limitation of access, combined with the implied breadth of knowledge contained within the four walls, led to the making of a powerful and enduring symbol. The job descriptions of persons working within the four walls has also been shaped by these roles. We are all familiar with the picture of the librarian with index finger pressed against pursed lips and glaring eyes gesturing the need for quiet in this place. While the practical intent of this was simply to argue for silence out of respect for other users who might be reading or studying, that shush, combined with other rules of what one could and could not do in this place, reinforced the symbolic power of the library. Yes, librarians were committed to assuring students and faculty could find needed information, but as a primary professional trust, they were especially committed to protecting the collections under their charges. The aforementioned roles of potent symbol and single point of access have been the primary drivers of academic library activity until very recently. The bulk of library energies and budgets over the years have been spent on building physical collections and physical facilities to accommodate them. The reputation of a university could be enhanced by pointing to the library's impressive book volume counts and numerous journal subscriptions. But this, combined with confidence in the ubiquity of the library on campus, led to a certain passivity in the face of coming changes. Librarians would ask, "Isn't the long-standing value of the library self-evident? Why would the library ever need to advocate for itself or define its value in new ways?" Don't get me wrong. Libraries have frequently been at the forefront of technological adoption on university campuses over the years. But the ready embrace of new information technologies, including the dramatic growth and impact of electronic information resources, is now adding particular force for libraries to reconsider historic roles and the sense of privilege that came with them. I would submit that it is precisely the primary roles of potent symbol and single point of access that are jeopardized in a world where print ceases to be the dominant technology of information storage and dissemination. The notion of the library as a storehouse of accumulated human knowledge is breaking down as users come to favor the efficiency and convenience of electronic information resources, even at the sacrifice or certain sacrifice of quality. Print collections are increasingly being marginalized, not because they've lost their content value, but because they lack the desired mobility. This transition has already largely occurred with regards to academic journals. Print periodicals have all been but abandoned by students who can easily access a full-text journal article from an online database with a click of a mouse or the tap of a screen. As I mentioned earlier, print books will not disappear from the library collection anytime soon, but going forward, they will be purchased in far fewer numbers, and over time, they will comprise a minority of a library's total book holdings, if this isn't already true, you know. It certainly is true in my library at Milligan College. While definitely counterintuitive to historic understandings, libraries are increasingly renting through subscriptions the books and journal titles that they make available to their users. Libraries are coming to terms with such reprioritizing concepts as ownership versus access and just-in-time versus just-in-case, as they think more closely about the educational context that they serve. For example, apart from special and archival collections, in a liberal arts university context, library collections should be oriented toward use. The mandate of the library here is to provide access at the point of need, and our users are turning increasingly to the electronic. This last year, we reached something of a tipping point at my library where full-text requests for e-books accounted for over 54% of our total book circulation. Related in implication to this increasing shift in the electronic composition of library collections is the realization that the library is no longer the single point of access to information and knowledge resources. Today, students have many points of information access provided by a web browser and a Google search. In the early days of this internet thing, librarians and faculty decried the unreliability of resources to be found there. And while it is true that there is still a lot of garbage on the web, and resources there should not be used without vigorous evaluation, increasingly, the web is hosting an amazing array of high-quality information repositories and scholarship. I am, for example, on an editorial board of an academic journal that is disseminated entirely online and is made freely available for access to anyone with an internet connection without subscription price. More and more artifacts of human knowledge are moving online, and libraries are becoming increasingly marginalized in this role. The earlier prohibitions are starting to sound a bit shrill. The professor can still tell his or her students to go to the library, but it's no longer because it's the only choice available. If the library is the appropriate choice among the many that are available to our students today, it is in part because the library is pushing its resources towards students in a low-friction manner via its website, and in part because the professor, with the assistance of a librarian through information literacy instruction, is intentionally engaged with students regarding information resource selection and use. I have a professor friend at Milligan College who requests many books for the library, a librarian's dream, actually, in terms of collection development. I appreciate that he actively participates with the library in building our library collection. One day I asked him how his students discover the many excellent books he has requested for the library over the years. And his serious reply was that he assumed, that's his first mistake, his students were motivated enough to come to the library and browse the shelves. I have another professor friend who also requests many books for the library. I don't have to ask him about his students, how his students discover the books he has requested, because he ties the use of these books to assignments on his course syllabi, and because he brings his students into the library. With the help of our instruction librarian, he shows them how to effectively use the resources that he has requested. I appreciate that my first friend intends to treat his students as naturally inquisitive and mature in their research habits, but he is desperately out of touch with the information use behaviors of his students in the internet world. High tech must be accompanied by high touch. It is easy to guess whose books are actually getting used. Brings us to new opportunities for the Liberal Arts University Library. I have asserted that the primary and long-standing roles for the library are in collapse or retreat as a result of a rapidly changing information environment catalyzed by the internet and the World Wide Web. But rather than pronounce the eulogy, I'd like to suggest several new opportunities for the library in the internet world. Many of these opportunities are dispositional, and many draw upon existing library expertise. I don't have time here to go into too much detail, but I believe that as these opportunities are seized and capitalized upon, new roles for the library will present themselves, positioning the library for a relevant and durable future on campus. And even in the conversations that I've had up to present, I'm happy to suggest that our librarians here are already beginning, or have for some time, pushed out some of the things that I will be talking about here. From passive to active. This is a dispositional stance. Library service has always been responsive to user need. Consider, for example, that library staff are typically very friendly and helpful kind of people. But the library hasn't always taken the initiative to update, connect, and insinuate its services into what is happening in other parts of the campus. For many students, faculty, and administration, there is a vague consciousness of the library and what it does, but it doesn't impact their lives and work in significant or dynamic ways. This stance, as I suggested earlier, is a carryover from a time when the library was the exclusive information access point on campus. Today, the library needs to make the case for its value, the value that it provides. It needs to be actively promoting its services on campus. Passive no longer fits in today's world. Turning toward the user, I would summarize this stance as moving from a library way of doing things to learning about and tailoring services to user needs and user ways of doing things. The shift here is from collections to services. In an earlier time, so much of library activity was focused on building, organizing, and protecting the library collection. And in truth, the collection was the library's most valuable asset. So a raft of rules, procedures, and security gauntlets grew up around proper collection access. This tended to alienate the typical library user. It was tolerated as a necessary evil because the library was the single point of information access. But when alternative information access points become available, user tolerance for this kind of friction falls precipitously, and users begin to take their business elsewhere. Library-centric practice must give way to a user-centered focus. Tear down the walls. The library in the print world lived within four walls as a physical space housing a physical collection. Now, through online and electronic information resources, the library is able to extend its reach beyond the four walls. The library can now be wherever its users are, whether working from home, in their dorm room, or in the Wi-Fi-equipped coffee shop downtown. But that website from 2005 won't cut it. If you've ever tried to load a desktop website on a mobile phone, you know what I'm talking about. If we are to have a virtual presence that will attract our users, our website and related applications must be full-functioned, well-designed, aesthetically pleasing, easy to navigate, and device-aware. New skills for staff. The previous point underscores in just one area how library staff today need to be equipped with new skills that are tech literate, user-facing, adaptable, and continuously being updated. Collection management skills, while not unimportant, are playing a much less prominent role in today's library, unless they are oriented toward electronic and digital collections. In a complex information environment, we need librarians and staff who are visible, engaged with students, and actively collaborating with faculty around topics such as research process, information literacy, intellectual property and copyright, open access, data curation, and digital humanities, just to name a few. Leverage interdisciplinary expertise as a context for collaboration. One of the frequently overlooked strengths of the library is that it lives and interacts in an interdisciplinary context. In the past, This has focused on collection development and subject specialization for bibliographic instruction. This natural strength combined with an active stance is a powerful tool for collaboration. It is easy to get stuck in our silos, but when librarians get out from behind the four walls, they are naturally positioned to talk with everyone because they have been trained to see the connections between academic disciplines and across various campus units. Revision and modernize library spaces. Many library buildings on university campuses from the print era are dully utilitarian, designed to privilege physical collections. Often, only the barest of space was provided for the library user, assuming they actually wanted to be there at all. The library of today that wishes to respond to the needs and concerns of its users will think differently about space. The shift in collection focus from physical to electronic has the potential of freeing up spaces for users. These spaces will be flexible, inviting, comfortable, domestic, which includes food and drink, welcoming of social interaction, and supportive of a wide range of learning activities, including knowledge creation, not just knowledge consumption. Assuming that the university administration doesn't simply view underutilized library spaces as opportunities for easy land grabs, and I have to be careful here, exciting collaboration with other academic support units such as math and writing centers, tutoring services, maker spaces, etc., have the potential of invigorating the library as a vibrant hub or commons for learning centrally located on campus. And so the idea of an academic commons holds a lot of attraction for me. In conclusion, since I began with a cartoon, it only seems fitting that I should conclude in like manner. Here is a strip from Calvin and Hobbes, my favorite comic of all time. I'm still in mourning after Bill Watterson decided to stop writing it in 1995. I chose this particular strip because I believe it speaks affirmingly to the engaged role that the library can play in supporting a real-world and experiential learning program such as you have here at Eastern Mennonite University. And I've got this on self-play, so... I hope that didn't go by too quickly for you. Did you catch that? Well, I don't want to risk diluting the simple power of the strip through too much analysis. The role of the library that I see here is in the provision of tools. That's that panel there where Hobbes suggests that that Calvin's mom might provide a book for further investigation about snakes. And the professional expertise, the mom, to empower the student to inform and derive meaning from his or her experiences in learning. What is key is the recognition that the need for information does not exist in a vacuum. Information must be contextualized into the experience of learning and meaning making. When Calvin says, "We don't know anything," that isn't quite true. He has learned a lot through direct experience and observation, and this has triggered curiosity and the desire to learn more. When Hobbes says, "If nobody makes you do it, it counts as fun," he is recognizing that despite all too frequent appearances to the contrary, the desire to learn is really quite natural. It's a fundamental part of what it means to be human. This is serious fun, and I definitely want the library to be involved. So thank you very much, and at this point I will entertain any questions that you might have. Oh. Yes, Nancy.
I'm interested in the sort of interface between your tear down the walls and your space claim suggestions.
That's right.
Because they are related, but they're also somewhat in tension, I think.
Yeah.
And you made a little side sort of throwaway comment about someone else wanting the space for something else.
Yes.
Which could be part of that. Given that the space is there.
Yeah.
But the task of attracting people into the space or making whatever, tearing down the walls. What's the way librarians kind of walk in the middle of that, doing both of those things, recognizing that we are still talking about there's a building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I hope you didn't hear me say that I don't want there to be a building.
Yeah. No.
Jim and I had a great conversation just prior, and I told him that what we do, we have this phrase regarding our library website. We say the library is always open at library.milligan.edu. And what we're communicating there is that the website isn't just just a part of what the library does. The website is the library when our users are engaging with that as opposed to the physical building. So in other words, if they are in the coffee shop downtown working on an assignment, they can and should be able to seamlessly and with as little friction as possible access as many of the resources that they need to conduct their research or to complete their assignments as if they were physically present in the library. Now, there's a certain overstatement about that, but that's certainly an aspiration that's, I'd say, 80% true, and I think maybe can be improved upon even further. Yes, so the fact that we have libraries in physical space is because we have artifacts of human knowledge as physical artifacts. So physical artifacts take up physical space. And that will continue to be true too. Again, the books will continue to be purchased. But I think it is true that the building that was built for the collection is no longer the building that we need for the library today. What we do or can hopefully take advantage of is the opportunity that shift affords for us. So for instance, and this is where I saw some of the things that I haven't actually been in the library yet. I think that's happening tomorrow. Okay. So it'll be interesting to get the space. But I do know that you do have, for instance, other academic support going on in the library. What I hope there is it's not just that here was a convenient place to place a writing center or a math center or a tutoring center, but that there's a synergy there, that this is academics, what is happening here, this is an academic hub, okay? So it's not just about books anymore in the library, it's about this vibrant mix, this dynamic mix where books and librarians and instruction and academic support and just wonderful spaces where people can, you know, stretch out and, well, careful about that, but social interaction, have great conversations, you know, study in silence if they want to, study as groups if they want to, have conversations, do performance, do rehearsals, that kind of thing. The prospect of recapturing, you know, not just in a symbolic way, but in a real way, the library as an academic hub for a campus is what I'm thinking about there. So yeah, there is some negotiation that has to happen, you know, there between, oh, this is our space, and, you know, we have to think more about this is our space, and this is how we're going to, you know, rethink it. I think it's a great opportunity to have something already there as opposed to not having something there. Does that help? Yeah.
You talked about a couple of you had pictures of two different professor friends.
Yes.
One of whom who ordered great materials and then expected the students would be
right.
Naturally curious and go check it out, and the other one who was much more proactive.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that highlights the fact that it's not just the librarians who need to be paying attention to how technology is changing the
right.
way students gather information, but the rest of campus as well. So I'm curious how do you work with that?
Well, that's a conversation. And again, I think the assumption is that, you know, like we're, you know, our specializations, you know, this is our gig and this is your gig. More conversation has to happen around, and when it does, you know, when a librarian reaches out to a faculty member who may be a personal friend, and they say, you know, hey, let's work on, you know, on doing this really creative assignment in the library kind of thing. And that becomes then this thing that you can showcase, you know, to others, is a real, again, a real exciting opportunity that can happen there. You know, I think it's like this. You know, people, it happens all around. I mean, you know, we have a picture in our head about what the library is all about, and it was formulated at some point in our own career as a student, typically, okay? And so the problem with that picture is that it may not be up to date, and so we need to update the pictures in our heads. Some of that you can see naturally in the way, say, younger faculty, you know, they have a totally different view of what the library is all about and what it can do for them and their students than maybe somebody who's been at it for a lot longer. And again, that's neither good nor bad. It's just that it's interesting. You know, this is no longer the library. The library that you have in your the picture that you have of the library in your head no longer exists. If you are constructing your course instruction and your teaching around an outdated picture of the library, that's a detriment to your students. It really is. And it's a detriment to you because you're not making use of the resources that might be there that could make your teaching a better thing too. So more collaboration too, I think, is a good thing there. Yeah, Michael.
Thanks for an intriguing brief presentation, Gary. I'm constantly interested in the question of print books versus e-books, and you know, mm-hmm. 54% tipping point that Milligan, wow.
Yeah.
I have four Kindles, so that tells you something about my approach.
Yeah.
But I keep seeing data suggesting that people repeatedly say that genre fiction is sort of the growth comfort zone for ebooks. And a lot of ongoing questioning about whether for serious research and a massive text, they really want an ebook. And I find myself, I go for ebooks for excerpts, and I love it if the library gives me direct access into the ebook when I need to see what this page says. Mm-hmm. But if I'm going to try to master a book, I want the book. Right. Do you have any thoughts on how libraries are going to resolve that conundrum?
Right. Yeah, I think, honestly, I think the delivery mechanism is not quite ready for prime time. I mean, it's fully usable, but I think journal articles, no problem. I mean, the ship has sailed like years ago already now. And just think of, you know, how much space can be can be regained by culling shelves of unused bound periodicals. There just to get off topic for just a second, there we have the problem is that, wait a second, this is a real thing, and we've made this investment in it, and therefore, you know, we have to hold on to it. Yeah, except that it's not being used. And if our mandate is to use the resources, then that's not the tipping, what is that? Return on investment, the crossover point is. But anyway, further to your point about ebooks, yeah, that's why I think it's a both and instead of either or. The short answer in the short term. here's the thing that I got as pushback from reporting that little stat is like, well, you know, yeah, but if you're counting an ebook, full text ebook request as a circulation, you know, how do you know that your users is really using that book? And, you know, and my pushback was, well, somebody can check out a book that they never open, too. So it's both, you know, there's that, you know, it works both ways there. I do think that the mechanism is different for use. I do think in general students and even faculty, as you just said, tend to use electronic monographs for accessing excerpts, for finding, you know, zeroing in on pertinent texts and stuff like that. Is it cover to cover reading on an ebook? Probably not. But again, how many monographs do we read cover to cover? We tend to read monographs to respond to our research needs, don't we? So we grab an excerpt, we grab a chapter. You know, as you say, the only books we're reading cover to cover, whether physical or electronic, tend to be, you know, genre fiction or something. You know, I think that's true. Or a really engaging, you know, how many really engaging monographs, you know, for that? We don't use books that way, those kinds of books that way. So, but I think the delivery mechanism is still coming along, you know. I was telling Jim when we were talking about, I saw this demo of an ebook presentation where one of the genius things about a codex is you can find yourself in space. You know when you're, you know, a third of the way through the book kind of thing, or you remember it was on the top left of, you know, about there, you know, that's wonderful. And this demonstration is emulating by, in the columns, the margins, it shows the relative distance through the book in a graphical way, and you can and those margins are hot linked too, so you can actually page through them from the margins. It's really amazing, and I think something like that will make e-books much more usable, even beyond just the content value of them now. Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
Sorry. Go ahead. Oh, I was hearing you talk about the website, and yeah, that's some of my background, so I looked up your website for the library, mm-hmm, and it's pretty impressive. I'm wondering if it might be helpful to pull it up.
Oh, yeah, I would be happy to, yeah. We've got this
we've got this great guy I just hired. We use it on, let's see if it's fine. Okay, I think I'm, did I?
Are you connected to
I think I, am I connected already?
I don't know.
Let me just see, I think I am. Because I think I used it before. No, okay. So, okay, I got my login. Do you want me to?
Maybe
if I turn this off.
Oh, yeah.
So as I was about to say, David Baker is his name. This was sort of what I meant by staff skill sets. We actually went outside the library profession to get this guy. He's from a computer science background. This is more an iteration, but we built our website off of WordPress, locally hosted, and it's fully responsive. It's geared toward resource discovery. And we do have some tools there that help. We've got EBSCO Discovery Service, which allows for cross-resource searching and that kind of thing. We've got a tabbed widget, which will come up shortly, except for the 29 updates that will. But we took a lot of pride in this website because it is part of our philosophy about the website being the library at the point at which users use it outside the physical space.
It was organized around both a search and a browse paradigm, and that it's very visually oriented.
Yes.
It's at an Amazon storefront where you see new books.
Yeah, that's a library thing widget. It's our new books that come up, and it provides a bit of a dynamic element to, and then in fact when
library.milligan.edu
MILLIGAN.edu. Okay. Yeah, so here it is. And actually, just what we just pushed out is this tabbed widget, which allows. What we're having a difficulty with is thinking about resources that are still like lists of database, for instance. It's a directory structure, and there seems to be, how do we get past that? So what we decided to do there is allow for a drop down, and you choose a broad subject category so that you can then at least get into a list really quickly. This is the library thing widget that shows some of our new books. And in fact, if you click on any one of those books, it goes to our catalog, and you can check it out from there. We've got maybe I should chat in right now. Probably not. We've got it, and you do too, but we click on that. That's why library help brings up a chat box. We've got current hours for the day, contact information. We've got a Twitter feed, which we push, updates to. The WordPress allows for, you can't get lost on any page. You've got this master menu. You can always find your way back home to where you need to be. I'm really proud of it. And of course, let's see here. So what I mean by responsive design here. So there's your smartphone, and it's fully usable from there, you know. Or if you got your tablet or your desktop, you know, it just responds. So that's our site, and then we've got our social media gigs and all that stuff too. So
I imagine, you know, maybe in the future, if you're not already doing this, departments could potentially curate a section of virtual books like that.
That's true. Yeah.
Visual communication arts department could have books showcased.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great idea, by the way. Yeah.
Is your chat line 24/7?
It is not, but it's also it is attached to an email. Like if you leave a question, we'll respond. Yeah, because it's staffed by librarians during hours. Yeah.
Thank you.
Ben, did you had a question?
Just a point of clarification, make sure I understood what you said. When you say that the distribution method for ebooks, it sounded like you were really talking more about the presentation, what it looks like on the screen or on Kindle.
Right.
How the book gets to you.
Right, yeah.
Just making sure I understand.
Exactly, yeah. We would use the, if we're using, whatever the vendor platform would be, and if they allow for downloading, offline downloading and stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
We should probably wrap this up because he has to get over his next interview. But, we're keeping him busy. Any urgent last question? If not, thank you all for coming. And thank you, Dave.
Thank you.